Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you each and every Sunday here on News Talk 580 KMJ and worldwide at KMJ580.com. Each week we visit with veterans of World War II, whether they be male or female, Army or Navy, Coast Guard, Marine. Name it. There are so many different ways that more than 16 million Americans served our country during World War II. You know them as the Greatest Generation, and I'm proud to have a member of that Greatest Generation with me today. If you put him in the spectrum of all the veterans who've been on this program, he's younger ones. Edgar Dethridge isn't even 83 years old yet, so he's got a lot of time left to tell his stories and pull some new tricks. But we're going to hear about some of the tricks that he pulled during World War II, some of the adventures that he has, some of the obstacles that he faced during his time in the U.S. Navy. And how did you end up in the Navy? Was that a conscious decision, or did Uncle Sam make that decision for you?
I had idea about how to get into the service. My parents didn't have an equal idea about it, so I decided that I would get into the V-12 program in the Navy. That was the one where you continued to go to college.
Right.
And I would just flunk out of college and get called active duty. That was my game plan.
That's pretty creative. I doubt many guys who came up with a plan like that.
For a 16-year-old, that wasn't too bad.
And you were here in Fresno, right?
In Fresno, uh-huh.
You moved here when you were a young boy?
Four years old. I came from Idaho. Moved down here from Idaho and moved onto a little farm out in 10 miles west of Fresno in the Central High School District.
So you're in Central High School when you concocted this plan of how I'm going to end up in the Navy?
Yes.
There's not a whole lot of water around Central High School, so maybe the Navy is pretty attractive. And is that how it played out?
Yes. It worked out well. I started college, and then I got interested in college. And after 1 year, they called me to active duty. So I reported for active duty, went through midshipman school, earned a commission, and then was assigned to the amphibious training base at Fort Pierce, Florida, where we learned how to land Marines on beaches.
Now, I imagine with the war having been going on for a while, what year is this now that you...
This is 1942 that I enlisted, 1943 that I was called to active duty.
So you had seen the newsreels and read the newspapers, knew that there was some pretty thick and heavy action going on.
Yes, I was aware of that.
That said, did the training that you got, you talked about amphibious training at Fort Pierce, Florida, did that training prepare you at all for what you'd actually encounter once you got to combat?
It was pretty skimpy. It probably taught us the best was how to take care of ourselves and how to be careful and how to handle the ship under adverse conditions. And landing on an enemy-held beach was a pretty adverse condition. So I think that's the main thing that I learned.
Did you find an instant bond, a camaraderie with your fellow sailors, or is that something that for a while you thought, I don't know if the Navy's what I'm cut out for?
I think the smaller the ship, the more camaraderie there is. I think the more friends, when you get them on the big ships, there's more Navy brass and things like that, protocol. But we had a friendly ship. There were five officers and 70 men, and we were all civilians at heart. I don't think there was a USN Navy man on the ship. So we fought a good fight.
Well, and let's talk about that. When you started fighting, do you remember your first taste of what the war was like when you actually some action for the first time?
We were commissioned in Philadelphia and came all the way around from Philadelphia down around through Panama Canal to San Diego to Hawaii to Eniwetok to Saipan to Okinawa. It was about a three-month trip.
I was going to say, that's a pretty long journey.
And our maximum speed was about 12 knots, so we could make maybe 200 to 250 miles a day, and that was it.
And tell our listeners about the ship you were on and what its purpose was.
We were to land on enemy beaches, Marines, soldiers, equipment of all kinds. We landed tanks and trucks and jeeps and then supplies of all kinds. There was everything from toothpaste to bombs. And we landed on the beaches, and they were beach parties were there to take over whatever we landed and process them from there. And then we got the heck out of there.
That's nice to be able to get the heck out of there. So that was LSM 424, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And for those who don't know, LSM stands for?
Landing Ship Medium.
And your duties on LSM 424?
Well, I was one of five officers, and I had quite a few duties, but the main one was communications officer. I was a watch officer as well, and we did a little bit of everything, really, on a ship that size.
Is there some pressure involved in that? It sounds like a decent amount of responsibility for you.
Well, I think you're prepared for it by the time you've got it, so I never felt that I was under pressure. I was expecting to do my best, and I did. I tried to, and I think that was the extent of it.
So the first time that you had to carry out one of these landings and put troops and supplies ashore, where was that, and what was that experience like through your eyes?
That was at Okinawa. And it was a experience I'd been waiting for the two prior years that I was in the Navy to do something like that. And it was exciting. I didn't feel necessarily that it was dangerous. We didn't get that close in contact with the enemy. We had a few kamikaze planes fly over and a few things like that. But
oh, that's no
big
deal.
We weren't under fire constantly or anything like that.
Yeah, just a few kamikazes trying to take our ship out. How close did they come?
Oh, probably the closest one was about 50 yards, and we weren't the target. He just, he flew over us looking for a bigger game.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like you weren't overly concerned with the possibility that that your life could be taken during the course of this. I imagine that's a fairly constant reality, though.
You know, Paul, it's a different thing to say. I don't think that I was ever worried. I was scared sometimes, but I don't think I ever worried about what was going to happen tomorrow or what was going to happen next week. It was something that I couldn't do anything about, so I just lived with it.
Was there one thing that you saw or maybe heard or felt or experienced that you would say was the epitome of the welcome to the war moment where it hits you that, oh, this is what it's going to be like. This is for real. I am actually here and I'm at war.
Well, I think probably the experience that I think of most is the typhoons that we got into on our way out of the Marianas into Okinawa. And they were fierce. And I think you mentioned earlier to me that you had a program with a man who was one of the three destroyers that were sunk.
That's right, well, last week's program. Yeah.
We were right in the middle of that. And it was a troublesome time, I'd say. I wouldn't say I was fearful. It was just something that we had to live with.
So that was actually before,
you
got to Okinawa.
Yes. Uh-huh.
So before you ever came in contact with the enemy, you came in contact with Mother Nature pretty severely. Well, I want to discuss that further, and we're going to talk about those typhoons that the LSM 424 and Edgar Dethridge encountered in the winter of 1944 before they got to Okinawa during World War II. He also has a very interesting, a bit of a lighthearted, and a very unique story to tell about an experience that he had. In fact, his first trip in an airplane. You're going to have to stick around for that. We're going to take a short break, come back with more of Edgar Dethridge, Valley Veteran War II, as Hometown Heroes continues on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Like to listen to the rest of that, but got to get back to the program here. By the way, Anchors Away there, performed by the local Sounds of Freedom band. Hopefully you caught them in Madera last weekend, or maybe even at the Changing of the Guard up in Sausalito at the Army Corps of Engineers. Those are a couple of the events they've played recently. I'll keep you posted on their upcoming performances, too. It's great to have such a capable band made up of many veterans and also members of our younger generations. The local Sounds of Freedom band heard there performing Anchors Away. That's a tune that our guest, Edgar Dethridge, has heard a time or two over the last six decades. If you missed the beginning of the program, you missed him telling you how he ended up in the Navy out of Central High School just west of Fresno. How he ended up on an LSM, LSM 424, didn't see his first combat until Okinawa, but on the way there ran into a little bit of Mother Nature's fireworks. Tell us about the first typhoon that you encountered and what that felt like. Did you have any warning at all that this was coming?
There was a good warning system that they used in the Western Pacific there to warn ships of heavy storms, and we had an early warning of this, but you never knew exactly when and where it was going to happen. And the captain had to be a pretty good guesser to maneuver away instead of into the path of the thing. So we did a fairly good job, but we got into one hellish one that the recorded winds on it were 150 miles an hour.
Holy moly.
And we were on a ship, as I explained to you earlier, without a keel. So we bounced in all directions, and it was a severe possibility of capsizing.
I would imagine
if
so.
If one of these things hit us just the wrong way. And before we hit the height of this thing, I had the what we call the mid-watch. I was up on the con, the mid-watch, which is 12 midnight to 4 a.m. And when I got off, I just hit the sack, tired out. And I came to about 6 o'clock in the morning, and the ship was really bouncing around. So I got up and put my clothes on and decided to go back up to the conning tower. Well, I got up there, and I had a heck of a time getting up the ladder and getting the heavy steel door open so that I could get into the convoy. I waited until the ship rolled just the right way, and then I opened the door with the roll, and then I closed it. I was all alone up there.
Well, this sounds like one of those crazy scenes from an Indiana Jones movie or something, trying to hold on the ladder with these winds.
The captain had secured, that's Navy, he says nobody goes up onto the conning tower. It was we were supposed to be there. I didn't get the word because I was sacked out.
So I got up there.
And I couldn't get down.
Okay, so this is the highest point on the ship.
Yes.
The conning tower in the middle of it.
That's where we handled it and ran the ship from there.
In other words, when you have the keelless ship, bounced left, bounced right, port and starboard, I suppose, and with wind gusts up to 150 miles an hour, the point that's going to get tossed around the most is the highest point of the ship.
Yes.
And that was you.
That was me.
What were you thinking?
Well, I was trying to figure out how to get down from there, but the captain thought better of sending somebody up to help me, so I just stayed. I wasn't in any more danger up there than I was down in any other part of the ship, so I just hung on until things got quieted down a little bit and I could come down a little more comfortably.
You may not have been in danger, but I imagine you haven't had quite as wild of a ride since then.
It was a wild one, I'll tell you.
What did that feel? I mean, were you secured in a seat? Were you standing, holding on to things?
I could have been. I could have had a seat belt and fastened to a seat up there, but I didn't. I held on kind of like this, and so I could balance and roll with the ship. So
I imagine you could see quite a bit from up there, too.
Well, there wasn't much to see. It was full of waves and water, and so there was nothing to see except ocean.
What was going through your mind at that moment?
Well, I just was hoping it would quiet down so I could get off of this spot that I'd put myself in.
Did it occur to you at that time that there was a pretty good possibility that the ship could go over?
Yeah, but if it did, I was in no more danger than the rest of the people on the ship were, so I didn't endanger myself just more than anybody else.
So what happened? When did it calm down?
It calmed down about the middle of the morning, got down to the point where a couple of guys came up to hold the door open for me so I could get out and come back down the ladder, and told not to go up there again.
Did you get in trouble for being up there?
No.
So that was the first typhoon? Or that was the wildest one?
I think it was the first. I'm not exactly sure of the order of it, but I think it was the first. These were scattered over about a 2 or 3 month period.
Did it ever get old? Did it ever seem like routine or old hat for you?
I think we ultimately got a little used to it. It's not something that you enjoy getting used to, but we had to live with it, so we managed.
You mentioned the last show that I had, Bob McNutt from Visalia was our guest, and he was one of just 6 survivors of the sinking of the USS Monahan, one of 3 destroyers that sank in December of 1944 with a very vicious typhoon that Bull Halsey, the admiral later, said that did more damage than a lot of actual battles to the Third Fleet of the U.S. Navy. Now, your ship was touched by that typhoon as well?
Yes. I'm not sure that we were in as long as they were. And we were a little, by design, we could kind of bob around like a cork mm-hmm. the thing that was described going over.
Sure, riding with the waves.
Mm-hmm. And the bigger ships, the ones that had trouble, and the destroyers, they were particularly unsuited for weather of that kind.
Do you remember hearing about what happened to those three destroyers at the time?
Yes, I do. I remember it distinctly.
Tell me about it. What was that like?
Well, they just got caught and tried to maneuver. And the secret in outlasting a typhoon is to the relationship you put your ship in with the way the waves are breaking. And if you don't get it in the right situation or the wind changes all of a sudden, well, it can just completely turn you over. In our particular case, we just sort of bounced around a little bit more, and we didn't capsize.
Did it mean anything to you when you heard about what had happened to those three destroyers? Was obviously you had been in high school when Pearl Harbor happened. I'm sure you'd heard about some of the huge battles between Pearl Harbor and at that point during the war. But was it any different trying to fathom and account for that loss of life than it would be if they were claimed by enemy fire?
That's kind of a hard question to answer. I was concerned about the loss of life. I had nothing to do with it, no way of helping to prevent it. It was just a happening of nature, and you sort of learn to live with those things, I guess. It was not a happy occasion by any means, but I don't know there was any better or any worse than being sunk by 16-inch gunfire. I don't know.
I guess maybe a better question is, and maybe this wouldn't be the only case, but a lot of the veterans that I talk to, they have that could have been me moment, or maybe it wasn't even, they had a close call where a shell came within a few inches of them, but they could have been on duty where a ship was sunk or a shell hit or anything like that. A situation like that, when you see other ships sinking in a typhoon, does it kind of hit you like that? That could have been me?
Well, number one, we didn't actually see the ship sink. We were not close enough for that, or the weather wasn't good enough so we could. So we were aware of it after the fact that it had happened, and there was nothing that we could do to help.
Right.
And we felt grieved and badly about it. They were Navy shipmates, in a sense, and we regretted it. But that's one of the things that happen in situations like that.
So how many typhoons do you remember enduring?
Three
typhoons.
Yeah, big ones. Little ones and little ones.
And you're not signing up for any more anytime soon?
Not soon.
Had your fill. So eventually you end up at Okinawa, which so many people know is one of the major battles at the end of the war.
It was the bloodiest battle in the Pacific, and it was the last big one of World War II. Yeah.
How much of a taste of that did you get firsthand? I'm sure you heard a lot of reports, but were there things that you saw with your two eyes that really made an impression, an impact on you?
Well, unlike the Marines and the soldiers who were on the island itself, we were not fighting on the island. We were away from it, so we didn't get that close proximity to the things that happened. We had more dangerous things happen to us than rifle fire, but that didn't seem to be as difficult to accustom to as the direct contact. I would have been unsuited, I think, for land, for fighting in the trenches. I don't think I would have enjoyed that as much. I don't like the word enjoy. I don't think I would have been able to tolerate that as much as I did my shipboard experiences.
Why do you say that? Just because of the things you have to see and feel and smell?
Yeah. Well, if you have if a ship is sunk, for example, that is a huge event. If a couple of riflemen are taken out on an attack, that's not such a big event. I don't know if I'm trying to explain that properly. About the concern you would have would be for the big event rather than the individual events.
You talked about your ship landing troops, landing supplies. Did you do any evacuation of troops?
Yes, occasionally. To move them around from one beach to another.
Did you ever get a taste? I get a look at some of the guys who'd been wounded, who'd been injured, who'd even been killed, and did that make an impact on you?
Yes, that all has an effect. It has a saddening effect. It's a difficult thing to have to go through.
Is that something that eventually you get desensitized to, or does it hit you just as hard every time?
I never did. I never got desensitized to it. It's just something that happens. And it doesn't always happen predictably. So it's a surprise in many occasions.
Is it melodramatic to say that things like that would strengthen your resolve or remind you of what you were fighting for?
I suppose it would, yeah. If you're going to go through all that way, you better have a reason for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a fitting spot for our next commercial break. When we come back, we'll get a little more lighthearted. I want to hear this story about the B-29. Wait, a Navy guy and a B-29? How did those two intertwine? We're going to get the answer when Hometown Heroes continues. More with Fresno's Edgar Dethridge here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Tell us about your hometown hero. Email your story by clicking on the Hometown Heroes link at kmj580.com.
Keep listening to Artie Shaw. I'd love to let you, but we've got to get back on with our interview today. That's Stardust, of course, by the great Artie Shaw. By request of Edgar Dethridge, our guest today. He remembers that song from way back when. Maybe you do, too. Or maybe if you're younger like me, you are trying to learn something from this program. I learn something each and every week when we visit with Valley veterans of World War II. If there's a veteran in your life that you think I ought to catch up with and have as a guest on this program, you can send me an email. Paul@kmj580.com is the place to send it. Don't forget, when you go to our website, kmj580.com, you can download podcast versions of this program, Hometown Heroes. Each week we post the newest version of the program for you to find online in case you miss a little bit of the show or something. Let's continue now with Edgar Dethridge, and I suppose that Stardust is a fitting song to take us into our next topic because you have the distinction of being one of the very few Navy man to take a little ride in a B-29. I've got to hear how this happened. How in the world did you end up in the bombardier seat, the nose of that big bomber?
I guess I was just lucky.
Well, I guess that's one explanation, but I don't think we'll get much of an interview if you just tell me that.
We talked a little bit earlier about our trip out to Okinawa. We went through Saipan on the way to Okinawa, which had just been captured by the Marines and the Army. And it was made into a giant air base.
Right.
And they introduced the B-29. I hadn't even heard about the B-29. That they kept it a big secret. But when they got them out to Saipan and started flying them, why, that was something. And we were parked right there by Saipan, and I had nothing to do one afternoon. And I decided I would go to the Isley Field, as it was named, and see if I could find out something about what a B-29 was. So I hitchhiked a ride with a passing boat and got onto the island and walked over to the airbase. My memory tells me there weren't any restrictions on it. Anybody could get there that wanted to. So,
well, I was just going to say, and I don't want to make you lose your train of thought, though. Imagine something like this taking place today. There's no way you'd get even close to one of those
right.
airplanes. But in this atmosphere, they see your uniform, they trust you are who you say you are, and like you say, you hitchhiked your way over there. That wouldn't happen today either.
That was it. So I was fascinated by just looking at them lined up along on their apron there, dozens of them.
Had you ever seen a plane that big before?
Never. There never was a plane that big before. And I was just completely taken with them, and the operations shack was there, so I went up to the operations shack and asked the operations manager if I could go out on the apron there and maybe get into one of them. And he said, he pointed one out down the way there, said, that ship, we just put a new engine in it, and the crew is going to take it up and test the engine. If you want to go for a ride, I think the captain would probably take you for a ride.
Did you think he was pulling your leg when he
said
that?
Well, I wasn't sure.
So you were wearing a Navy uniform.
I ran, didn't walk down to that plane and introduced myself, and the man had given me a little note of introduction, and he said, sure, we'd be glad to have you. And he issued me a parachute and a an inflatable Mae West, I think they call them.
And you knew exactly what to do with both of those, right? You've been in the air so much.
I didn't. Nobody told me either. So the captain showed me around, and he put me up in the bombardier's seat because the bombardier wasn't going on this ride. It was the pilot, the co-pilot, the pilot, co-pilot, engineer, and radio man. And they were going to test the engine. So he put me up in the nose. And if you've ever been near a B-29, the nose is way up there. I was up there all by myself.
And the bombardier seat is in front of the pilot and co-pilot. You're actually
way in front of the nose. And there's a transparency there that you can see everything around you. That's what's for the purposes of the bombardier's job.
And if anybody at home wants to go experience something like that, I don't think they'll get the ride that you got. But, you know, Castle Air Museum, just right up the road from Fresno in Atwater. I know we've got a lot of listeners there in Merced and Atwater, and they've probably experienced this. But they have a B-29
on the ground
at Castle.
Yes.
I actually climbed up in that very seat, the bombardier seat. Only my mistake was I did that in early July or late June, and it was about 100 degrees outside.
A little hot.
It was about 180 in that bombardier seat. But I trust the accommodations were a little better for you in 1945.
If it was too hot, I didn't notice it. The pilot came up and showed me around, and he said, "Now that's our bomb site," and it was covered with a canvas cover. And he said, "Just don't touch it. Just leave it like it is, and don't pay any attention to it." And it was not in my way in any way, but he didn't tell me how to put on my parachute or my other equipment or how to fasten my seatbelt, and so I just sort of improvised that, and I survived it. So I guess I did it fairly right.
Now, there's another important element of this story. You had never, ever been in an airplane before, right?
Never, ever been in an airplane of any size.
Not even a crop duster out in West Fresno.
Not a crop duster, not a Piper Cub, not a nothing.
So the biggest plane in the world at that time is your first ride.
Right.
And you're sitting it from the very nose of the plane. So I imagine the end of the runway looks a lot closer to you than it does to anybody else.
Well, it does. And we got started and taxied down the taxiway to get in on the runway, and I looked on the runway and I could see this hump in the runway. Well, it turns out that they were building this airbase in such a hurry that they didn't take the trouble to blast out a coral reef that was there. They just leveled it off a little bit. So when you take off in that airbase, you go up and then back down again and then off the end of the island. I was absolutely fascinated and terrified at the same instant when we started to run down that runway. And we went over the little hump, and I looked down, and there's the end of the island, and we're still on the runway, and finally we raise up, and we make it off without running into the ocean.
So basically you're saying this coral reef that they tried to lower a little bit was kind of like a speed bump on the runway.
It would be, yeah. It would be something of that nature. It was a big long thing, maybe 20 feet long. It wasn't very high, maybe that high.
So then the end of the island got there pretty quick, too.
Yeah, if you didn't get off by the time it got to the end of the island, you got a bath in the Pacific Ocean.
And that wasn't what you asked for.
That wasn't my intention, no. Well, anyway, we did get off safely, and we were up in the air, and there wasn't much to see after we got up there. There were a few little islands scattered around, but the ocean was beautiful, and I was absolutely fascinated. And we're flying along, and I'm just enjoying the daylights out of myself. And I looked over my right shoulder, and there flying on our wing was a Marine Corsair fighter plane.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what was going on. I had a communication that I could hear some of the things that were being talked about, but they were talking to the Marine, and I wasn't on that connection. So I didn't know what they were doing. And I didn't find out until we landed that the pilot had forgotten to turn on his IFF. And IFF is identification, friend or foe, and it's tied into your radar. And when you have that, why, they can identify you as being friendly. If you don't have that and you're in an airplane near an airbase during World War II, they come up and shoot you down.
Right.
So
so here you are, just going for a joyride, and it turns out that they had scrambled a Marine fighter pilot to see if you guys were renegades.
To get rid of us, if necessary. So we got past that little hump, and and they're out doing their tests and right. And we got to the end of the line to head back toward the base where we made a U-turn, and the pilot came up and said, "No, I'm going to turn on the automatic pilot." They call it George. Perhaps you've heard that term.
Sure. Yeah.
He was going to turn on George, and George on that plane was connected with the bomb site. So he came up and fiddled around with some dials and some knobs and whatever you have, and then he said, "Okay, we're all set now. We're flying on George." Said I, "Just don't touch anything again on this thing." So I didn't touch anything, and we flew along. And I'm listening to the conversation on the radio, just having a glorious day, a glorious day. And
were you at all, did you ever look to see if you could see your ship down there anywhere?
I looked over it all the time, but where we there weren't any ships on that side of the island, I guess, but I didn't see any.
You didn't ask them to buzz LSM 424 so you could wave or anything, huh?
That would have been a little presumptuous.
A little too much. Anyway, I interrupted.
Anyway, we got to the point where the pilot came back and he said, "Oh, we're going to approaching getting ready to land, so I'm going to have to turn George off and go back to manually flying the plane." So he went in and flipped his knobs and nozzles and dials and so forth and said, "It's disconnected. We're flying the plane ourselves," and said, "If that's in your way, just pull it away." So I grabbed the bomb sight and pulled it around like that, and the plane went into a hard right-hand turn, and the pilot landed on his behind at the end of the bombardier's compartment. and he yelled at me to let go of that thing. So I did, and he had not disconnected it like he thought he had.
So for he came a brief up and, moment, you were for, flying that
was,
plane.
That was my point. I was the only Navy officer, as far as I knew, in the entire World War II that piloted a B-29, albeit only for an instant.
And you threw the pilot on his behind.
On his behind, yes. I was not very kind to him.
Was he nice to you when you landed?
Well, he apparently radioed ahead, and the crew met me, and I was a personality with them. They made me an honorary crew member, gave me a little handwritten certificate, and they all applauded me and congratulated me, and I was a part of their crew.
I was waiting for you to tell me that to pay you back for knocking him on his rear, he gave you a bit of a bumpy landing or a nose first or something.
I think he was as amused by the whole thing as I was. Ultimately amused. I was a little bit concerned at the time, but everything worked out well. And I remembered that story. And not too long ago, in years, maybe 3 years ago, there was a story in the Fresno Bee by a friend of mine who was a B-29 pilot during World War II. So I told him my story, and he verified that all of that is entirely possible. It could happen, and probably did happen the way you described it. So it has been 60 years since I had it happen, so I tried to be accurate.
Out of curiosity, what's his name?
Jensen.
Roger Jensen.
Roger Jensen. Yeah,
friend
he
of mine.
The last
too.
Flight off of World War II. At
the last bombing mission of World War II, and there's a great book written about that mentions him. And you know, I did a story with him on television, and after that, got some letters from the other pilot on that plane's family. And he and Roger were the two pilots on that. The Horrible Monster was the name of their B-29. You've got his story written.
I brought that along. That's just a letter that I wrote him.
Very nice. Very nice. So you are. Do you think there's any other Navy men that flew B-29s?
Well, they haven't made themselves known to me, if there are any. And I will, until I'm verified, firm verification that there is some, I'm not going to assume that there are any. I'm going to be an exclusive product.
Well, there ought to be some kind of commendation or citation for that, don't you think?
Well, I tried to get it in my record for longevity purposes, but they wouldn't... they wouldn't accede to that.
How long would you estimate that the plane was under your control when you yanked that bomb sight and the plane took a dive to the right? How long was it before the pilot regained control?
In seconds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But for a few seconds,
I was a pilot in the Army Air Force.
Navy uniform or not, that is a great story. And now here's, I guess, the bigger question. When you got back to your ship and told that story, did anybody believe you?
I don't think so. I wasn't famous for fabricating, but I don't think anybody believed that would ever happen to anyone.
Seemed like too big of a stretch, huh?
Yes.
I think we ought to get that in Reader's Digest or somewhere. And I know you've written out that story, so And we're glad that you've shared it with us, with all of our listeners here today. So you've just heard Edgar Dethridge, the only Navy man to fly a B-29, if only for a few seconds. He was making that plane move. That's another good stopping point. We'll catch our final commercial break here, come back, and come down the home stretch of Hometown Heroes. Fresno's Edgar Dethridge, our guest this week on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Guest is a veteran of the Pacific Theater of Operations in World War II. I think that song is very appropriate, too, as men and women both in the service and back at home looked forward to the end of hostilities during the biggest conflict the world has ever seen. We speak, of course, of World War II, as we do each and every week here on Hometown Heroes. And again, the time has gone by pretty quickly now in our final segment with Fresno veteran Edgar Dethridge. You heard him talk about his time in the Navy, what it felt like to see combat for the first time, surviving three typhoons aboard an LSM in the Pacific, and then the lighthearted story of becoming perhaps the only Navy man to ever fly a B-29, if only for a moment, when he jerked that bomb sight and the autopilot still engaged, turned that plane a little bit. That was a very entertaining story, and he has a few more to share before our time is up. But since we just heard White Cliffs of Dover and the insinuation there being looking forward to the end of the war and a victory for the Allies, where were you when VJ Day happened? You're a Pacific Theater guy. What do you remember about that, and what did it mean to you at the time?
Well, we were at Okinawa. We were anchored in a bay on the east of Okinawa called Buckner Bay or Nagagasuku 1, and the information came over our radio that indicated that the war was going to be over. It wasn't factual at that moment, but it was shortly thereafter. And it ended just like that. And there were some grand fireworks displays from the ships in the harbor. Everybody fired everything they had. And I got out of the way. I got down. We had shrapnel all over our ship's deck the next day from that. But it was a good celebration.
Well, and if everybody fired everything, then you better hope the war was really over. Otherwise, you'd have nothing left.
Well, I'm not sure everybody fired everything, but they fired a lot. Many of the ships went to Japan and to participate in the ceremony.
Sure.
We got sent to China, and we went over to the port city of Qingwangtao, which is downstream from Tientsin, which is a port city for Peking.
Mm-hmm.
To give you the location we were in.
Little geography.
And
yep.
We landed supplies. We were supplying the Marines again, who were disarming the Japanese, and we were not supposed to go off the ship. And a young lady stopped by one day right after we got there and brought us a box of cookies. A white Russian lady, I'd say in her middle 20s, and she invited us to come to her home and meet her family, my father and mother and so forth, give us an address and everything else. And so I got off watch. I went down to our old salty gunnery officer and told him about it. He says, well, let's go. I said, we can't. We can't get out of this. We'll go. So we left the ship, and we're wandering around in the streets of Tientsin. And we came around a corner, and coming down the street facing us was a Japanese patrol. They were still running the city, as they had an agreement with the Marines to maintain policing the city until they could be disarmed.
Right.
So we shrunk back into the doorway there and tried to be non-conspicuous. In this platoon, there were six or seven of them under a sergeant or a lieutenant or whoever. And they stopped right in front of us, did a right face to face us. The man saluted, turned around, walked off.
And you breathed a big sigh of relief.
Yes. But we met this family. They were wonderful people. They were intelligentsia white Russians that were fugitives from the Russian Revolution, and Asia was full of them. And this man told us exactly what was going to happen in China. He said, this is what the, and it happened just the way he predicted it, and we lost China.
As far as Chiang Kai-shek versus the communist forces and everything? Wow. So he had it all figured out ahead of time.
He did. He was a very, very brilliant man. I have another little small world story that goes along with that.
All right.
After I was out of the Navy and in the broadcasting business, I was calling on one of my clients who was an appliance distributor, and he had a secretary sitting at the front desk who had a very unusual accent. And I was talking to her one day, and I said, where did you get the accent? She says, well, I'm a white Russian, and I came from the Philippines. That's where I met my husband. We was in the Army, and we got married. And I said, oh, I met a family up in the Tenzin, the white Russians I gave her. And says, that's my cousin.
Wow.
How's that for a small world story?
That's a small world for you. Well, so, and maybe he had your life figured out, too, besides everything that was going to happen and unfold in China. Now, you had a few more lighthearted stories to share. And you know, we hear so often on this show the intensity of war, but it does provide for some of those moments that you remember for a long time with a smile on your face. Now, we already heard that you're the only Navy man to fly a B-29. You guys also ended up as one of the few LSMs to actually have a Jeep of your own?
Yes.
And that was, now, if I have this straight, you ran into a group of African-American soldiers who traded you a side of beef?
Well, they didn't. Their commanding officer did.
Their commanding officer, okay.
Now, the colonel, he wanted a side of beef. He didn't want it for his troops. He wanted it for himself, I think. So he offered us a Jeep in exchange. So
he was that hungry.
Yeah, we had a little beef to spare, and so we got a Jeep, and we were the only Atlantic ship in the whole Navy, I think, that had their own personal Jeep.
You should drive down Blackstone and see if that deal still applies at the Jeep dealership.
The way we got rid of it is kind of interesting. We didn't know what was going to happen. We showed up in San Francisco, which is where we were going when we came back to the States, and we had a Jeep aboard. So somewhere west of San Francisco, on the bottom of the ocean there, rests a Jeep that we let the bow doors down and the ramp down and pushed it over the side before we got there.
I won't give your address out because the environmentalists will be coming after you. So you had that Jeep for how long, though? And I imagine that
about 3 or 4 months.
A nice luxury to have.
Oh, yeah. We had a great deal with it. I think I mentioned to you that we were in Tsingtao and we went to met a family of ladies that ran a restaurant called the Four Sisters. And one of them was married to a jockey on the racetrack. So she invited to take us to the races one day. That was another officer and myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got into the Jeep, as they called it. And,
sure.
And went to the racetrack, and her husband was a lanky guy, and it didn't make any difference how big they were in China. That didn't seem to count. He was big as his horse was, but at any rate, I had a very, very good day at the races, and I made almost $12,000.
Wow.
Gambling on the races one day.
$12,000.
Yeah. You must understand that was Chinese dollars, and that was about $6 and change in American.
Makes for a better story if you don't put that disclaimer on the end. Well, and had you tried to bring that much money back, then you might have had to dump that in the ocean to the Jeep.
I'd been in trouble then, yeah. In deep trouble.
We've got about a minute and a half left in the show. I want to ask you before we bring this to a close, the time that you spent in the service, and obviously you have some very pleasant memories and some very stirring moments as well, but what do you think was the number one impact that the time you spent serving in the Navy had on the rest of your life coming all the way to today?
Very important. I think I learned discipline, for one thing. I learned how to accept orders, how to give orders, and how to work as a team. And it was absolutely mandatory in the Navy that you do that. And I learned a lesson, in a couple of cases, the hard way, but I learned it, and it stood me in good stead in the remainder of my career.
You ever look back and wonder what it would have been like had you not been in the Navy? Had you chosen another branch of service? Or
never thought, never give it a moment's thought.
You're thankful it worked out the way it did.
I think I was very fortunate to make it. Made a good choice, and it worked well for me.
And I'm sure it served you very well in the roller coaster world of broadcasting. You spent a lot of time in radio and television, and were really a pioneer in television here in the Valley. I imagine that gives you some pride still today.
Well, more kind of a pioneer in radio, too, than when I helped put KYNO on the air. I think we were the fourth radio station. How many are there here now?
There's more than that in this building. There's a few. And Channel 47 you put on the air,
yes,
too, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Well, since I worked there for 10 years, I want to thank you for that, because it was a big part of my life being there.
It was
there
a pleasure
as well.
For me.
I believe it. Well, it was a pleasure for me to have you on the program today. We're out of town now, but thank you, Edgar, for your service to our country and for sharing those memories with us.
Thank you, Paul. I appreciated it very much. I enjoyed it.
Right back at you. Edgar Dethridge, our guest today, will be back with another program next week. Remember, you can also check out Hometown Heroes at KMJ580.com. Send me your suggestions, Paul, at KMJ580.com. That's the program today. Thanks for listening on News Talk 580 KMJ.